Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm your host, Umbreen Khan. Each week, we explore the beliefs that shape our world. This week, we're taking a closer look at the backstory behind the murder of Harpreet Singh Nijjar. At the age of 45, the community leader and Gurdwara president was killed in an execution-style murder in the parking lot outside the Sikh temple in the Vancouver suburb of Surrey, home to a large Sikh population. Hate crimes and violence targeting Sikhs is not new, but this case is different. Canadian intelligence agencies do not suspect gangs or vigilantes inspired by white supremacists. Instead, they have credible evidence that a state actor is involved, the Indian government. Since the announcement, headlines have focused on the diplomatic fallout, visas being suspended, and diplomats from Canada being sent back to India. But the repercussions of the murder of the head of a local Sikh temple in Western Canada is reverberating across the diaspora and here in the United States. This week, we explore the relationship and what is happening here. As Prime Minister Modi's ascent into the leadership circle of global superpowers complicates an uncomfortable reality for India's allies that see a democratically elected leader advancing policies that are shifting the character of India from a secular democracy to an explicitly Hindu state. Home to religious minorities, including Buddhists, Jains, Zoroastrians, Baha'i, Protestant and Catholic Christians, Muslims, Sikhs, and indigenous tribal people, as well as many who do not identify with faith. The future of religious minorities in India, along with the crackdown on the press, have many concerned. But before we dive in, a little refresher. Sikhs are followers of Sikhi, often referred to as Sikhism in the West. It's the world's fifth largest religion with roots in the Punjab state of India. Founded in 1469 by Guru Nanak, the tradition's monotheistic. Its core beliefs reject caste differentiation and prioritize service. Their houses of worship are called Gurdwaras, and traditionally, they are open to all. In the aftermath of 9/11, Sikhs continue to be targets of hate and bias-motivated violence in North America. Over the last 20 years, many leaders in the Sikh community have become active in interfaith work to build relationships and solidarity with other religious minorities. For Tharanjit Singh Bhatalia, that became a mission, building bridges. The Ohio-based interfaith leader is active in interfaith work at the local, state, national, and global level. After the Prime Minister's announcement on September 18th, he saw the framing emerge, describing Harpreet Nijjar as a terror threat, an allegation that Canadian intelligence found no evidence of. Bhatalia felt compelled to speak out. In a September 26th opinion editorial to the Religion News Service, he calls for international accountability and sees the murder of Harpreet Singh Nijjar connected to an established practice and pattern of targeting Sikh activists critical of the Indian government, a practice, he says, that is now emboldened by religious ideology of the Hindutva, Hindu supremacy, what he says animates Prime Minister Modi's BJP government. I spoke to him on our studio line from his home in Columbus, Ohio. Tharanjit Singh Bhatalia, thank you so much for joining me. How is this impacting and being felt by the community where you live in Ohio?
I myself live in Columbus, Ohio, and I would say that the local community here is quite nervous at the developments that if what the Canadian Prime Minister has claimed that the government has evidence of is true, then how secure are Sikhs in Canada, U.S., and elsewhere? This last weekend, I happened to be at a conference in the same town, Surrey, where Mr. Hardeep Singh Nijjar was killed. It was scary. The community there is on edge because what they don't know is who's going to be next. There had been a similar killing last year of another Sikh activist in a similar manner. And this is the second time it has happened in that very city. So it is a time of extreme concern. Here in the U.S., the FBI, I understand from media reports, has also warned a couple of Sikh activists that they might be targets. And so this is really a time when the community is very nervous. And, you know, when religious communities get nervous, what do? They come together. They kind of withdraw to their enclaves. And I see some of that happening here in the U.S. and also in Canada.
The Prime Minister of Canada making this a national issue. Does that give comfort to the Sikh community in Canada and in North America?
Yes, it does. And I think what is important for our listeners to understand that this isn't the first time that the Sikh community in Canada feels that they are being blamed as well as being marginalized. The Sikh community has been quite concerned since 1985 off the hand of the Indian government. A lot of Sikhs, Canadian Sikhs I have talked with, feel that the fact that the Prime Minister raised it in the parliament so forthrightly, including confronting the current Prime Minister of India, Modi, during the G20 meeting, along with other leaders from the US and from the UK, we believe is a very positive development, which gives a little bit of assurance to the Sikh community that while India, yes, is an economic giant, and we need to do trade with India, we cannot give a pass to such kind of violation of international law if India indeed is involved in this assassination of a Canadian Sikh on a Canadian soil.
This has sparked quite a bit of reporting in India itself, and the stories that have been coming out paint a very different picture.
Nijjar was killed by unidentified assailants in June 2023 in Surrey in a Gurudwara premises. It was believed that it was an inter-gang rivalry. Canada, as of now, appears to have chosen to shelter the extremists and even pick a possible conflict with India. If their Prime Minister believes that such rhetorical actions or statements will help win support, he is highly mistaken, because it actually basically shows that terrorists are getting a free run in Canada and doesn't show him as a strong Prime Minister.
Why this soft peddling of extremists and this treating them with gloved hands or cotton wool?
Canada and its growing reputation as the safe haven for terrorists, for extremists, and for organized crime. And I think that's a country that needs to worry about its international reputation.
The Canadian Prime Minister made some allegations. What he was alleging was not consistent with our policy. But to understand that conversation, you have to also appreciate what we consider to be a very permissive Canadian attitude towards terrorists, extremists, people who openly advocate violence. And they have been given operating space in Canada because of the compulsions of Canadian politics.
Why is it important to unpack that framing?
Ever since the Sikh faith began in 1469 by the founder of the faith, it has always been against Brahminical or the practices of the religious elite who at that time controlled the Hindu tradition. Ever since the establishment of the faith, many Hindus have believed that the Sikh faith is not an independent religion and that it is a subset of Hinduism. And this particular point needs attention because since 1947, when the British created India and Pakistan in the partition of India, the Sikh kingdom that the British had annexed in 1849 was not given an independent status. And so the Sikhs at that time chose to throw their lot with India. Ever since, the Hinduization of the Sikh faith has been on full swing.
What I'm hearing you say is that there is an effort to deny the independent nature of the religious tradition as followers describe it, as adherents describe
Correct.
It, but rather a political campaign to describe the tradition as in fact being akin to a denomination or an offshoot or a stream of a larger tradition known as Hinduism.
Yes, and you put it more eloquently than I could. What this means is that as a Sikh, one is required to keep certain articles of the faith, as well as refrain from smoking and drinking alcohol. What Sikhs have experienced in the last, what, 70, 75 years living in India has been that a Sikh who is willing to give up those articles of the faith and is, you know, merely willing to drink alcohol, for example, is considered to be the ideal Indian Sikh. So that is the desirable Indian Sikh that, you know, many Hindus look at. And in essence, this person has given up the Sikh identity and values and has come back or returned to the fold of the Hindu tradition, which Sikhs respect as an independent world religion. And those who choose not to do so, so those who keep this identity and say, well, I can't have alcohol, they are considered to be separatists and they are not desirable.
When you see people within your own faith tradition who don't follow the five tenets, is their practice or lack of practice a reflection of their politics?
I think this operates at two levels. I would say till about 50 or 60 years ago, the practice of faith, there was a standard practice everyone had to follow. But where we are today as a community and as a world is we leave the practice for faith up to an individual's personal choice. So if a particular, you know, Sikh wants to drink alcohol, they make that decision, right? However, that decision to not keep the turban or not keep uncut hair, not keep the articles of the faith, and having alcohol, if that is driven by being better assimilated in the larger Hindu or Indian community, if that is the driver, that is what I'm talking about, is that there is this encouragement. Well, if you don't keep the turban, if you don't keep the article, don't be observant of the faith, you would be more welcome in the larger Indian Hindu dominated society. And that is where the friction begins. There is a strong desire by a majority of Hindus in India. And, you know, I have many, many friends, you know, I still go there regularly and I work with. They feel that Sikhs are a part of Hindu tradition that denies Sikhs and the religion the independence and the basic values of our religious tradition. So within India, there is extreme pressure on Sikhs to assimilate in society. So what that means is that many times successive governments in India have essentially seen this independence of Sikh faith from Hinduism as a point of friction. And anytime the Sikhs have asked for demands for the preservation of their religious, cultural, and linguistic rights, they are in essence framed as being separatists. An example I would give you recently was the farmers' protest that happened in India, which was a couple of years ago. And openly it was called, you know, one which was a Khalistani, a name used in which it is put up there, the Sikhs want an independent nation.
Translate what Khalistan means and what that is as a social political movement.
Sure. The word Khalistan comes from two Persian words that are brought together. Khalis in Persian means pure and stan means land. And the first demands for a independent state of Khalistan came just about 20 years before 1947. And the reason why those demands arose is that in 1849 is the British, when they conquered Punjab, it was the last province in South Asia to be conquered, was annexed to the British Kingdom. And when the British were to leave and began that process in 1920s and 1930s that followed till 47, the Sikhs had hoped that the Sikh kingdom would be returned back to the Sikh community, which did not happen. And as a result, Sikhs made at that time the best choice that they could to go with India. So there has been a desire within some sections of the Sikh community to have an independent state. However, during 1947, I think Sikh and Sikh community and our leaders had reconciled, saying, okay, that geopolitically, an independent Sikh nation is not possible. So let us try to throw our weight with India and work to find an independent identity and protect our faith and live out its values within the Democratic Republic of India. And my sense is that that was done in good faith. However, the last 70, 75 years, probably the last 10 years in India have shown the rise of religious nationalism through the ballot box. As a result of what we have seen in India is that Punjab was the last state which was organized along linguistic boundaries after a significant struggle. And during that struggle was the first time when the Indian media and the government started to use the issue of Khalistan as a beating stick for the Sikh community. So every time Sikhs would come and demand, saying we need more autonomy for Punjab, we would like to have a certain status for the city of Amritsar that Sikhs consider to be a holy city, all those demands were viewed by successive governments, not one particular one, as being separatist.
Mm.
And as a result, every time Sikhs asked for something, they were said, oh, you guys are being separatist, you know, you are asking for Khalistan. The same excuse was used by the Indian government in 1984 when the Indian army attacked Darbar Sahib or the Golden Temple in Amritsar and about 40 other Gurdwaras on the excuse that they were there to flush out Khalistan. And then in November of 1984, when Mrs. Gandhi was killed, there were pogroms in Delhi and across India in which Sikhs, you know, it was openly told, I remember I was there at the time, that Sikhs need to be taught a lesson. And then in the 1990s, there was large-scale mopping of young Sikh men who were arrested, taken to different places across Punjab, and then they were killed in police custody of faked encounters. And as a result, what has happened is that there is still a desire among the Sikh community to have a place in India where they can experience the glow of freedom. By that, what I mean is where they can practice their faith freely and fully and live out their culture and their values. That sense of freedom and to practice their faith is limited in India. And with the rise of Hindutva, that is further decreasing. Now, let me also in the same breath say to you that the time for new faith-based nations to be formed, I believe, is over. So I believe Sikhs have a very difficult choice. And so our own community, there are some who would passionately support that Sikhs need an independent Sikh state, a progressive, not a fundamentalist state. And there are others who would say, well, the time for making faith-based nations different. We should rather work with India and reform within India. And that dynamic conversation continues in the diaspora also. I firmly believe that India, in terms of its constitutional setup, is a pluralistic democracy. But in practice, in the last 75 years, I believe that India operates more as a Hindu assimilative society. The way the country operates is very assimilative in terms of the majority religious community. And that is why these kinds of challenges arise.
You've laid out a history that takes its roots in a colonial story.
My sense is it goes much further than that. That much of the Hindu community has viewed those Sikhs who claim that they are an independent world religion to be separatists from the time that Guru Nanak or our faith was born. There is, at least in India, a significant pressure on Sikhs to return to the Hindu fold. That, I think, is where the battle is.
Mm-hmm.
That is what's under the table, is to force the Sikhs, whether directly or indirectly. You know, there was the 1984 November killings in which, you know, 2,500 people were killed on the streets of Delhi in 3 days. Those are kind of things that bring a community to its knees. There is clearly a message that, you know, if you want to live in India, you will have to give up your independent faith identity, and then you are more acceptable. And if you are not, then you could be considered to be a fundamental separatist and terrorist with not much between those three continuums. They are used interchangeably.
You're saying this traces back to the founding of the tradition.
Yes, because my sense is, and, you know, like I said, I have many Hindu friends, I've read books and others. Many Hindus, right from the beginning, saw the Sikh faith as a reform within Hinduism and or a revolt against the Mughals at that time. And many of them believe that now the Mughals are gone, and so the Sikhs should simply come back to the Hindu tradition.
Mm.
And however, a very last majority of Sikhs actually find that offensive because it undermines our very identity of who we are. So what is really at stake in this entire conversation is the identity of the faith. That is what undergirds the current situation. And in much of India, you know, there's certain languages and terms and labels used. What I have observed, what might be considered to be a separatist, most South Asians in India would call that person a terrorist. Mm. So that's why you see that kind of language that is used in Indian media today, which is very, very provocative. In fact, it has gone to the extent of even referring to the Prime Minister of Canada, you know, as a terrorist. And so we have this inflammatory media that is further able to add fuel to the fire.
Dr. Tharanjit Singh Bhatalia spoke to me in his capacity as a trustee of the Sikh Council of Interfaith Relations. With 20 years of service in interfaith work, he remains active on the board of the Interfaith Association of Central Ohio and on the National Board of Faith and Public Life. Earlier this summer, he moderated sessions at the World Parliaments of Religion in his capacity as Executive Director of Religions for Peace. When we come back, Riya Chakrabarty from Hindus for Human Rights joins me to talk about the rise of Hindu nationalism, transnational repression, and how the killing of Harpreet Singh Nijjar has sparked calls for action.
Sikh Americans are facing another wave of this fear for just being who they are. When one of us is attacked or one of us is feeling fear, it's important for the rest of us to show up in solidarity for them.
You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan, and we'll be back after this short break. Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska. and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. Welcome back. I'm Amreen Khan, coming to you from Washington, D.C. If you're just joining this week on Inspired by Interfaith Voices, we're taking a closer look at the diplomatic tensions that erupted on September 18th when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau tells the Canadian Parliament that the country's security agency is actively pursuing credible allegations that link the Indian government's agents to the killing of Harpreet Singh Nijjar, a Canadian citizen known for campaigning for the creation of an independent Sikh homeland, Khalistan, carved out of India. Now, while that is not a widespread vision among Sikhs in India or the diaspora, it is a political rallying cry for many. Before British ruled the subcontinent, there was a loose confederacy of Sikh kings who governed the northern state, which at the time included parts of present-day Pakistan and India, the last holdout to fall under British rule. That's a point many Punjabis share with pride. Today, establishing a Sikh homeland is not popular. Depending on your point of view, the campaign for Khalistan might be described as a separatist movement to create a Sikh religious state, or one that promotes extremism and terror. Since gaining independence from British rule, efforts to create the state of Khalistan in Punjab have been viewed as a national security threat by successive Indian governments, including Indira Gandhi. She ordered a series of attacks that led to a massive outbreak in communal violence. She was assassinated by her bodyguards in retaliation. The history is fraught. Members of the Sikh community, a religious minority distinct from Muslims and Hindus, continue to face discrimination, political oppression, and violence. Today, to advocate for Khalistan in India is politically dangerous, and activities organizing to support a separate state are treated as seditious. But outside her borders, expats in the diaspora find political freedom to organize. According to the Indian government, these efforts are an existential threat. Since the diplomatic tensions between Canada and India erupted, the Modi government has denounced the allegations while accusing Canada of harboring extremists and terrorists, implying Nijjar's killing was justified. The issue of Khalistan has been weaponized. According to human rights advocates, when Sikhs speak out to call for human rights, just as they did 3 years ago during the farmers' protest, the Indian government portrayed their labor movement as an extremist call for separatism.
Anytime a Sikh comes up and says, well, we need this for our community, oh, you are a Khalistani, you're a separatist, you are a terrorist. The challenge is now it's the use of the beating stick.
That's Tharanjit Bhatalia. He's a trustee of the Sikh Council of Interfaith Relations and an advocate for human rights. Before the break, he said the economic and political migration of Sikhs to Western countries back in the 1970s and 80s was in part sparked by the violent crackdown and the discrimination during Indira Gandhi's time in leadership. In North America, the Sikh diaspora built communities with gurdwaras, temples, and community organizations that offer Sikhs an opportunity and ability to participate fully in public life. Canada, he says, is a model for this civic engagement. It's also home to the largest concentration of Sikhs outside the Punjab region in India. Jagmeet Singh, a Canadian Sikh, leads the National Democratic Party. That is a center-left opposition party that holds 38 seats in the House of Commons. And he's a key member of Trudeau's coalition. After Trudeau's announcement on September 18th, Singh spoke passionately about the need for justice during a party press conference. For the political leader, the attack on Niger was a reminder of the religious persecution his family fled in the 1980s.
A Canadian citizen was killed on Canadian soil and a foreign government was implicated. These are unprecedented intelligence that's come forward, and that is why we're going to continue to urge that the Canadian government have a thorough investigation, that those responsible are brought forward and held to account using the full weight of a Canadian legal system. For a long time, members of the Sikh community have been targeted by actions of the Indian government, and for a long time that it's gone often unnoticed or unrecognized. And for a lot of people, hearing the Prime Minister of a G7 nation provide intelligence that connects the killing of a Canadian on Canadian soil by a foreign government really confirmed a lot of the fears that people have felt and have made those fears even more real and more tangible. There's a lot of other diasporic communities from India who are critical of the Indian government or Indian government policies that share that fear, that have also been targeted because of their human rights activism or their critique of very oppressive policies of the Indian government. They also share that fear. And I speak of other religious minority communities like Muslims, other communities that are oppressed like women, and groups that are from low caste backgrounds or tribal backgrounds who've expressed deep concerns about the treatment that they've received. They're also feeling that real sense of fear and worry.
The rise of Sikh political influence in Canada is something Batalia says the diaspora in the U.S. aspires to.
What is now interesting is when you look at the Sikh community in Canada, the Sikh community in Canada is only about 2% of the population. However, at the political level, they are almost as influential as the Jewish community in the U.S. And so Sikhs from the U.S., when we look at across the border, in Canada, we look at the Sikh community there as something that we should work towards here in the U.S. So I think in the U.S., Sikhs don't have a lot of political power or authority, but the Canadian experiment of Sikh community is one that is worth exploring further and emulating to some extent. And I also hear the same sentiments from Sikh organizations in Europe too, where there are small minorities, but they aren't as influential as the Sikh community.
Despite the rising influence of Sikhs in Canada, the Niger killing underscores the risks of political activism.
There's a term for this. It's called transnational repression. We've seen this with other governments. For instance, Jamal Khashoggi being killed in a Turkish embassy by the Saudi government.
That's Riya Chakraborty. She's a foreign policy and human rights advocate. She studied the rise of state-sponsored and vigilante political violence, and she says combating transnational repression that targets Americans can be especially challenging when the perpetrators are allies.
We've heard this from the Iranian government, the Chinese government, the Russian government, and actually the U.S. has taken action against, for instance, like Uyghur activists who've talked about the Uyghur genocide in China. Many of those people have had their families interviewed or detained in Xinjiang province. They've been tailed or intimidated here. And those officials who have done this kind of intimidation have been sanctioned by the U.S. The problem, I think, that the Indian American community is coming up against, though, is that when lawmakers think of transnational repression, and they don't really want to talk about transnational repression from India or Egypt, sometimes they'll talk about Saudi Arabia, and Jamal Khashoggi is, of course, this brutal reminder of that particular country's efforts. But it's sometimes hard to then say this country that you all think of as a democracy is engaging in some of the same tactics as these other countries that you think of as autocracies.
In 2021, she wrote an editorial for Foreign Policy magazine detailing how the U.S. Department's own reports show a pattern of human rights violations and religious persecution in India. However, she points out that India has been shielded from U.S. sanctions in part because of the legislative protection afforded by the Indian Congressional Caucus leadership, including members like California Congressman Ro Khanna. He introduced amendments to bills that insulate the Modi government from sanctions for violations. But Trudeau's recent diplomatic challenge to Modi's government and security agency have emboldened interfaith activists to call for U.S. leadership. And as of this recording, nearly 100 organizations have signed a solidarity statement calling on U.S. faith, civic, and elected leaders to take action.
The White House and Congress must hold relevant investigations and closed-door briefings and ensure that Sikh Americans and other members of the Indian diaspora who engage in protected political expression and activism are safe from transnational repression and interference from the government of India, rising Hindu nationalist threats, online censorship, and government-sponsored cyber intimidation.
This statement is signed by a diverse group of multi-faith leaders and organizations, reflecting relationships forged in the wake of 9/11.
When one of us is attacked or one of us is feeling fear, it's important for the rest of us to show up in solidarity for them. That's where this came from. We wanted to show Sikh Americans that you have the support of our communities, but also that you have the support of the wider interfaith world. And so we have organizations that are broadly Asian American, as well as groups like the Interfaith Center of New York and Shoulder to Shoulder Campaign, who are part of this coalition of solidarity. We have the Movement for Black Lives that is a part of this. We started out focused on our groups within this Middle Eastern, North African, South Asian community, but we expanded to show that our across faith traditions and across communities of color, we're all in solidarity with each other. We have strength in numbers, and the more we all band together to say this is a problem, and the more we have solidarity statements, the more I think lawmakers on the Hill, but also the administration, will understand that this is a real problem for not just people who speak out against governments that the U.S. doesn't like, but also for governments that the U.S. has relationships, like strong security or trade relationships.
You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm talking with Riya Chakraborty. She's the public policy director for Hindus for Human Rights. We're talking about the crackdown on dissidents and the challenges of holding the Indian government accountable for human rights violations, and the reaction of Sikh allies in the United States to the killing of Harpreet Singh Nijjar. Let's get back to the conversation. At Hindus for Human Rights, based in New York, the power of the Indian government to target U.S. citizens is not abstract. This summer, Sunitha Viswant, the organization's executive director, was targeted and associated with an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory.
I have colleagues who are Kashmiri who have talked about their families being taken in for questioning. Our own executive director has been trolled at the highest levels of the Indian government, including a cabinet minister calling her part of a grand conspiracy with George Soros to destroy India.
A key tool used, social media. This tactic, according to Chakraborty, is not only pervasive and state-sponsored, it's very effective.
Trolling, for many of us, seems like just internet bullies, but this is a very coordinated campaign. So there, you'll have a conspiracy theory, for example, that a dissident is somehow associated with the Pakistani intelligence services or that a dissident is associated with George Soros. And then you'll have thousands of bots, because the Indian ecosystem includes these government-created troll farms where people will create fake accounts to just keep amplifying like a deluge of hate towards a certain person who is the focal point for trolling. And it will become so intense that the person who's being targeted will even sometimes get death threats. So a good example of this is that our executive director, Sunitha Viswanath, she was targeted in this conspiracy theory that she is an agent for George Soros. And George Soros, through her, is trying to destroy India. And it's a quite invasive theory because it also includes her partner, and it says that they were a match made for him to destroy Israel and her to destroy India from the inside out. And her partner is Jewish, by the way. So this is an incredibly anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. And both because the conspiracy theory is trying to raise the specter of George Soros, but also because it is targeting her partner as well.
In the case of Sunitha Viswanath, executive director of Hindus for Human Rights, the alleged tie to George Soros are based on his philanthropic efforts supporting an NGO that helps Afghan women. And it's a group that Viswanath also supports. Chakraborty says those details were omitted by government officials in the summer of June 2023, a retaliation for Viswanath's opposition to the rise of Hindutva, the right-wing Hindu nationalism that is a central focus of Prime Minister Modi's BJP party. Although Hindus for Human Rights is a small nonprofit, only 6 full-time employees and an operating budget of less than $1 million, the group's leader became a national political target for attending a meeting in New York with Rahul Gandhi, a member of the Congress party that is challenging Modi's leadership.
The question that has been left unanswered by the Congress party is this.
Cabinet Minister Smriti Irani, she's the Minister for Women and Minority Affairs, holding up a picture of Sunitha like at a national press conference and asking, why is Rahul Gandhi meeting with George Soros agent Sunitha Viswanath?
Is it true that Sri Gandhi met Sunitha Viswanath during his trip to the United States of America, when it is known to every Indian what George Soros intends to do? Why is Mr. Gandhi hobnobbing with those who are funded by George Soros? This is not the only Soros connection. Even in Mr. Gandhi's Bharat Jodo Yatra in Karnataka, the global vice president of the Open Society Foundation, funded by Mr. George Soros, was found accompanying Sri Gandhi.
When such a prominent individual makes a claim about an American on national television, that became an entire week of stories in every corner of the Indian media.
Despite the attacks on her boss, she is not deterred.
I'm a Hindu American, and that affords a lot of privilege for me, in the sense that I don't have to worry as much as someone who is Sikh American or who is Muslim American and has family in India of being intimidated. My last name kind of gives away that I am upper caste as well. And so I have a lot of privilege that protects me from some of the things that are very credible and real dangers for people in minority communities.
But Rhea is concerned about the Indian intelligence apparatus watching her every move.
I'll be honest that I am worried / concerned that I'm being surveilled, that our executive director Sunitha is being surveilled by the Indian government. But for me to say that I am afraid for my physical safety in the way that Sikh Americans or Muslim Americans are would be wrong. So I'm not as afraid, but it also means that I have a bigger responsibility to amplify the human rights concerns and stand in solidarity with those who come from communities that are far, far more vulnerable to this kind of intimidation and harassment from the Indian government.
Chakraborty is using what she calls her privilege as an upper caste Hindu to speak out about the extreme views within her own tradition that she sees as a threat to the democratic promise of India.
In the days before independence of India, there were two competing visions of what people wanted India to look like. On one hand, there was the secular socialist vision of what India should be, which is what won the day. And that's the independence movement that actually created the constitution. That's the movement that Gandhi became a part of. And then on the other hand, you had this Hindu nationalist vision. And that vision of India was one where the founders of this movement believed that the only way for India to survive and to be an independent nation was if people rallied around a strongman who wanted to construct an Indian identity based on a Hindu identity that is also an ethnic Hindu identity. And if that sounds very familiar, it's because it was very much in conversation with similar movements in the 1930s in places like Italy and Germany. And in fact, some of the Hindu nationalist leaders did go to Italy and Germany. The umbrella organization of the Hindu nationalist movement, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the RSS, was designed and inspired by Mussolini's black shirts.
But it's not just the history that drives her. It's a fear of what is at stake if they don't succeed.
I see India's democracy has been just like the pride of South Asia for so long. The idea of Indian democracy being destroyed before our eyes. There's no other way to put it. I see an Indian government intent on destroying the Indian Republic and replacing it with this Hindu nationalist vision of what they wanted India to be. And it's sad. I grew up with this idea of India being this place. I was always proud of being a daughter of India growing up. And it's sad to see that this is what India has become. I want to fully recognize that this is not the promise of India that many people, especially Sikh and Kashmiri people, have experienced when it comes to India. But like for the rest of Indian and Indian American community, the idea of what India was, the promise of India as a secular democracy enshrined in its constitution, that very idea of what India is just disappearing.
Riya Chakraborty is the policy director for Hindus for Human Rights. She leads the organization's advocacy efforts with government actors, and through her work, she's focused on understanding the effects of U.S. foreign policy on communities worldwide. Prior to joining Hindus for Human Rights, she studied political violence in the United States. Her research on the 2019 wave of democratic protests was published by the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies Journal of Global Affairs. She's also worked in a variety of positions in the United States Senate and World Health Organization. Riya is a graduate of the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, where she earned a Master's of Global Policy Studies with a concentration in international development. That's all for this week's show. If you're interested in learning more about our guest, head over to the episode page on our website at interfaithradio.org. While you're there, you can learn about us, read the show notes, sign up for our newsletter, and explore the archives. You can also take this podcast on the go. Just search Interfaith Voices in the podcatcher of your choice. And friends, while you're there, leave a message. It helps others find us. This week's episode was produced by Kevin McCarthy. Thanks to our founder, Maureen Fiedler, for her vision. Sounds in this week's episode are from Blue Dot Sessions and Audio Binger. Inspired is a production of Interfaith Voices, and we rely on the generous support of our listeners to bring you this show. Wherever you are, friends, I hope you are well, I hope you are safe, and I hope you stay connected. I'll see you next week.